105 Sport.
It's the third of our 105 Sport Ashes podcast recorded here at the Gwider Street studios of Cambridge 105 Community Radio. I'm Chris Stewart and with me is Dom Marsh. Now, things were grim at the Gabatoir for England, but this weekend it was a case of really, really bad Adelaide for Andy Flower's men. We look back at the second test and ask, is there any hope left for England? And just how good is this Australian side? Plus, we consider what changes the teams might make for the Wacker and the hard bouncy pitch at Mitchell Johnson's home ground, not to mention the infamous Fremantle Doctor. But first, back to day one at Adelaide. England did okay, took a few wickets. Carberry spilled a sitter of off Haddin, I think it was, wasn't it, near the end? And then just all went horribly wrong from there, Dom, really, didn't it?
Yes, well, it did go pretty much Australia's way from there, didn't it? We had Haddin, of course, go on to make a big 100 in partnership with Clark. And again, that sort of turned the tide of the match, really. So, again, I guess we had a situation where England dominated the early exchanges, and then, you know, from that point on, we're chasing the game, and you know, we're never really in the game, to be honest. I mean, once Australia makes or made 570, it was game over, really. You know, England, like we spoke about a few shows ago, aren't a team that score rapidly, perhaps with the exception of Peterson. They don't have the players that can, you know, really sort of take the game away from you and move the game forward at a good pace. So 570 going in late on day two. Really, at best, England were only ever hoping for a draw from that stage. To force a win was always going to be a big hope. And I think at that stage, once you're at that stage, it becomes very difficult for a team to actually play with any sort of positivity, I think.
Yeah, even when batsmen are in good nick, that's a difficult situation psychologically. And then the shape England are in at the moment, I mean, they just look absolutely shot to bits with the bat. They don't, like, a lot of them seem to be really struggling. And so, yeah, there was never really going to be any other result once you got to kind of tee on day two. And Johnson, to be fair to him, bowled exceptionally well in the first innings there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, to be fair to England as well, the tosses had an effect. Perhaps not so much in Brisbane, but I think certainly on the back of the result in Brisbane, to then go to Adelaide where they knew they had to put in a performance, it would have been extremely disappointing for Cook to have lost the toss and then realise on a featherbed Adelaide Oval pitch, you know, they had to really start off well and they had to really bowl Australia out for somewhere in the vicinity of, I guess, you know, between 200 and 300 relatively sort of quickly in order to set the game up. You know, so yeah, batting second, you know, was always going to be difficult for them in Adelaide, and you know, they never really sort of got into the game.
Yeah, but they did on day one give themselves half a chance, certainly if Carberry had held that catch of bowling them out for not much more than 300s. And then obviously, you know, the game plan is then bat for 2 days, which they managed to do 3 years ago, and then kind of try and bowl them out on the fifth day with two spinners in the side, which, you know, we said last time, well, I said that I was quite hoping Panesar would play. I didn't think he would, so I was quite pleased about that. That's one of the few things that kind of seemed to work for England. But obviously, they scored, you know, 170 or whatever it was, not 600. So that's it's the batsman that let them down there.
Yeah, I mean, don't underestimate either the physical nature of being in the field for 2 days. So, you know, the fact that, I mean, yes, England's batsmen are out of form. Yes, Johnson's had a huge impact. And the other bowlers have bowled extremely well as well. I mean, Johnson's taking the limelight, but I think he's been very, very well supported. So we can't sort of forget that fact. But, you know, England have batted second in both games. And to be in the field for, you know, great lengths of time, particularly in Adelaide in that second test when Australia made 570, they're already chasing the series. So that's a huge, not only mental impact, but also a physical impact, you know, to come out and then to have to bat straight away. And obviously we saw what happened to Cook getting cleaned up by Johnson early on. And, you know, he's got the weight of the world on his shoulders. And it just all snowballs from there.
You've been very kind to England, Dom. I agree with what you're saying, that they have still not dealt with it as well as you expect experienced test batsmen to do.
No, you're exactly right. They have been disappointing. You know, I guess, you know, I've read and heard a lot recently about them being a team, you know, in decline, about the end of the glory years and so forth. And That might be a little bit premature. I think they're a good side. My own personal view is I think they've always been a very, like I said, I've said a few times now, a methodical team, a workmanlike team, but a very effective team. And I don't think that has changed a lot. I've never rated them a great team, and I think, you know, perhaps in terms of English teams, they've certainly, you know, done very, very well, and their record has been very good. I would never classify them as one of the great teams, that's for sure. I do think that they went to Australia thinking that they only had to turn up to win. I do think that the 3-0 victory in England has played a part, and I do think there was complacency there. And I think that's really crept up on them. I don't think there were, you know, Australia and England were poles apart during the English summer. I think it was a lot closer than the scoreline suggested, and I do honestly think that England went there just expecting to win, and now that they realise where they are, Johnson's had a huge impact. I think it's hard for them to arrest that momentum.
That's interesting. I mean, I guess it, you know, with that farcical finish at the Oval as well, it could even have been 4-0.
Yeah.
But maybe 2-1 would have been a better result for England in terms of going into this, if you're right there.
Absolutely, absolutely.
A bit more of a wake-up call.
Yes.
And the last time England scored 400 in a test match in one innings was 12 tests ago. And that's just unbelievable. And this is, so that's seven Ashes test matches in a row where with their highest scores, 370-odd. And this is a team that have, you know, these guys, Cook, Trott, Peterson, Bell, that are meant to be great, and, you know, is this kind of showing them up that actually they're just good players, not great players, but they've been effective on, you know, in fairly kind conditions against not particularly great bowling over the last few years, or is it, you know, a genuine kind of downturn in form, bit of both?
I think perhaps it's a bit of both. I mean, Peterson and Cook, yes, I think that they will go down as, you know, great English players. You know, their records stack up. I think Cook particularly, he's got a long time to go in the game and his record is already pretty phenomenal. Peterson, I guess, more for the way he plays the game and can take a game away from you. His stats are very, very good. And so he'll be remembered as a great player, a match winner. Bell, Trott, more, you know, they're very good players, no doubt. But more your sort of workmanlike, you know, methodical players that I've been talking about. So what would be interesting to find out, I guess, would be, you know, that test where they last scored 400, what Cook's contribution was, because he's had a very lean 12 months. And I think that's had a huge impact, particularly now that Trott's not there.
Well, it was the first test in New Zealand when they were skittled in the first innings and trying to save the game in the second innings. And yeah, Cook's contribution was 100, and as Cook and Compton both got hundreds in a big opening partnership. So yeah.
That doesn't surprise me. I mean, I do think that Cook's decline, I guess, over the last, well, pretty much this year, has had a big impact. Now, whether or not the captaincy's impacting his play, it's difficult to know. But he at the moment, he's a pale imitation of, you know, what he was 12 months ago. And I think that's having a big impact on England, particularly because his opening partner of the last 12 months, and there have been a few of them, have all been relatively inexperienced.
Yeah.
So when you match that with Cook's poor form and losing Trott now, you know, they're pretty big shoes to fill. And then, you know, by the time we get to Bell at five, You know, a lot of the damage has been done. Exactly. Yeah. And we spoke and I said that Root would bat at three, and he did. And there was a lot of talk that perhaps Bell should have batted at three. And a lot of the commentators think that Bell should have batted at three. I can understand that, definitely. And perhaps that is a way, is a way forward, because the theory is, I guess, you're getting him in before the damage is done.
It's only, and we'll come to Perth in a bit and what England might do. But yeah, it's interesting because actually all the top five and prior have scored a 50 in the series in two matches. You know, and obviously they've not played well, but they've all now had a bit of time at the crease. They've had one half decent knock. There is potential for the managing to turn it around, and it's not obvious if you're going to drop one of them which one it would be. But like I say, we'll come back to that a bit later. I mean, obviously, just to continue with what happened at Adelaide, England 172 all out, and it was Johnson that finished them off. But it wasn't really him that did the damage early. It was England themselves, like throwing away a couple of silly wickets, But once they lost Carberry on 111, then Johnson came to the party and ended up with 7 for 40. But it was six of those seven were the last six wickets to fall. Was it just Johnson's kind of pace and ferocity that England just couldn't deal with? Is there technical things that we need to be looking at here? Or was it more just kind of the momentum of the game and the kind of, you know, the cauldron, the atmosphere, the tension?
I think it's
not
all
dealing with that.
Yeah, I think it's a good question, and I think it's all of the above, to be honest with you. I think Johnson has definitely surprised them. I don't think England expected this of them. I think, you know, they would have been happy to admit that he was capable of it, but I think deep down they didn't really expect it. And after Brisbane going to Adelaide, particularly having witnessed Australia's first innings and knowing the kind of pitch it is there, and seeing how Australia batted, it was a slow wicket, a bit of a feather bed, really. I think Johnson really, again, caught them by surprise. His speed through the air. And what he's been able to do is he's mixed it up. So he's not just a big thing for him at the moment is obviously that short ball. But in Adelaide, he got a lot of wickets by pitching the ball up as well. He went through Cook, for instance, early on, and I think that really sort of surprised England as well and rattled them a little bit. So he wasn't just a one-trick pony, if you like. And he's, like we've said, he's been very, very well supported as well by the other bowlers, and they're putting a lot of pressure on them as well. Johnson's control, he also got a bit of movement through the air in Adelaide. And that's been a big difference. I mean, the thing about Johnson is, and this is another thing that's putting pressure on the England top order, in my view, and that's he's really nullified any lower order runs from England.
Yeah.
And the English have, you know, generally been pretty good at, you know, amassing a few scores in that lower order just to sort of, you know, boost totals and maybe sort of, you know, help the batsmen out when they haven't performed.
Broad and Swan just look absolutely
shell-shocked.
Like they haven't got a clue.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's the impact that he's had. So they know England, that as soon as they get to, six or seven, so Stokes it was in Adelaide and prior, you know, they're only a ball away from really being skittled. So that's putting a lot of extra pressure on the top five as well. Because the top five actually have, I mean, yes, he's bowled very, very well, and he's probably, you know, he might have hit a few of them, etc., but they haven't played him too badly.
Yeah.
It's been the damage he's done, you know, once they've got to sort of four or five down, then it's just been, you know, lights out.
Yeah, good
and
point.
That's been a huge difference.
Hmm. England, they bowled okay in the second innings, actually. I mean, Warner did well, but Anderson got a couple of early ones. Panesar bowled a beauty to get Clark in the second innings. What was your reaction when you woke up on day four to find that Australia had declared overnight? Was that a surprise? Did you expect them to bat on a bit longer?
I guess
Duplessis factor was in the back of someone's mind, maybe? Or
Was it
just a case of this is one, it doesn't matter?
No, I don't think so. I think they probably had every intention on batting on the morning of day four. But I think with the forecasts and a bit of rain around, I think that they, you know, they figured, oh, we've got 500 odd now. If this isn't enough, then we won't deserve to win. And they didn't want to be in a position where, you know, they came within sort of, you know, one or two or three wickets from winning the game and to be scuppered by weather. So I think they figured, no, you know, let's not take any risks. Let's get them in and knock them over as quickly as we can. And, you know, and probably the right decision in the end.
With Panesar and Anderson in the side as well.
Yeah. The old Cardiff duo.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that was, I mean, I think Clark as well would have liked to have allowed Warner 100. So it was a gutsy decision and a brave decision and the right decision, I think. And I'm sure Warner would have accepted it.
Oh, I'm sure he will. Water off the duck's back to that guy. He's not the kind of guy to get caught up in that kind of thing, is he?
No.
Definitely got kind of begrudging liking / modicum of respect for David Warner. He talks really well and comes across, you know, his kind of personality comes across is not just, another kind of towing the media line. He's entertaining, good value in his press conferences and, you need people like that in the game, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially in the way he bats as well, crikey.
Yeah.
The other thing I just wanted to touch on was two stats here. One is, in the series so far, 21 of England's wickets have been catches on the leg side, apparently, which is interesting. And in the second innings at Adelaide, trying to bat two days to save the game, none of the 10 wickets that were taken were deliveries that would have hit the stumps. Now, am I oversimplifying things here? Or you're thinking, all you have to do is stay in. If it's not going to hit the stumps, leave it. What are you doing? I mean, I'm sure I'm oversimplifying it, but at the same time, does that tell any kind of story? Are England just a bit psyched out and don't really know what kind of, like you kind of hinted at before, it's difficult to psychologically to bat when you're not really got anything to aim for? But we've seen England, you know, make a better fist of trying to save a game in the last few years than that, whether they've managed it or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good question. That is the statistic. What we have to remember is, I guess, that even though these wickets are falling, the ball, it's not LBW or hitting the stumps, it doesn't mean necessarily that they're not good balls. It could be, you know, nick offs behind and so on and so forth. I mean, in this case, actually, there were a lot of outfield catches. What I would say is that I think they're frazzled. That's probably the best way to describe it. You only have to look at Cook's dismissal in that first, innings. I think it was either the first, certainly Johnson's first over. I can't remember if it was the first or second over of the innings.
Yeah, Johnson's first, the second.
And, I mean, again, I think it was good bowling by Johnson. I mean, they have this plan to Cook at the moment to pitch it up and get him playing around that off stump and getting him nicking off and LBWs and so on and so forth. And all of a sudden, he sees a short one. And, you know, that's one of his strengths, the cut, the pull, a couple of his strengths, one of his biggest strengths. So he figures, wrongly in hindsight, I'm going to go for this. You know, so again, that frazzled mind, it's caught him by surprise, goes for it, finds Harris in the deep.
That was interesting. A few people kind of called that uncharacteristic, if you're in the media, like uncharacteristic shot from Cook. I would kind of put my hand in the air and say, actually, I don't think it was. I think he does that early on in matches a few times, but normally he gets away with it. And I remember against New Zealand, him kind of hooking early, whether it's a pull or a hook, I can't remember. But he, you know, it was in the air, landed safe. No, everyone forgets about it. He gets two runs and the game moves on and then he kind of knuckles down. But, you know, I think that is good bowling from Mitchell Johnson. I think he has spotted that Cook occasionally kind of can't resist the pull shot. And he also knows that he's not in particularly good form at the moment. He's likely not to play it very well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you look at the dismissal as well, I think he was probably beaten by pace a little bit as well. It was just a good example of some good bowling. I guess the Carberry dismissal is a little bit more disappointing because he's just seen his captain fall that same way not long after he plays the same shot. I think there must have been four or five of the English batsman caught at deep square or fine leg in that second innings. And you just have to look at Australia's game plan. I mean, the lower order particularly have been, you know, they're frazzled. I think the pace of Johnson has worried them. This bouncer short ball barrage that the Australians are quite openly, you know, admitting to deploying against them is really sort of playing with their minds. So I think they're just in that they were probably in a state of mind at that stage where they just thought, you know, if they're going to bowl short, I'm going to hit it, rather than sort of the ducking and the weaving. I think it's really been good. A good tactic by Australia. It casts your mind back to the West Indies of the 80s and early 90s, and that's what they did to opposing lower orders and opposing fast bowlers. They just hit them with bounces and the short ball barrage, and it certainly affects you, probably not so much your bowling, but certainly affects your batting.
Yeah.
And it makes a big difference. I mean, and then you've got Bell, probably overconfident. I mean, he's Smith's bunny at the moment, isn't he? Smith seems to get him out for fun.
Yeah. So three of his 9 test wickets are Ian Bell.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, then you look at some others. I mean, I think Swan nicked off, and I think Root was caught a good catch by Haddon behind the stumps. So, I mean, yeah, whilst that wasn't going to hit the stumps, it was a decent delivery, and so he was unlucky. So it's just one of those statistics, I guess. But certainly the Australian, you know, assault on that lower middle order, and the lower order is really affecting the English.
Yeah, and I thought a word for Panesar. I thought he did really well batting with Bell in the first innings.
Yes,
because, you know, he was getting peppered by Johnson, and you know, he stood up to him, and you know, he did well.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the English fans just love Monty, you know, and that's the kind of thing that, you know, endears him to them even more.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's 2-0 on to Perth, which we mentioned before that Adelaide was a massive game because England are almost certainly going to lose in Perth. Now it's actually upon us. How difficult is it to see anything other than an Australian win and winning the Ashes back?
I think if you're a betting man, you would be backing Australia, to be honest. Not only because of the fact that it's sort of another fortress for Australia, not too dissimilar to the Gabba, but also if you were looking at the mental state of both teams at the moment and where momentum was, and it's very difficult to arrest that. You only have to look back at 06-07, where England, particularly in Adelaide, played actually some good cricket. Yes, they lost that match, but it's very difficult then to slow that momentum down and things keep building. So I think if you're a betting man, you'd have to sort of bet Australia. For me personally, I don't think it's impossible to see England coming back. I think the teams are meeting on an incline-decline at the moment. I think Australia is on the way up and England perhaps on the way down. But I think England are still a very, very good side. And I think Australia still have some frailties. The batting order for me, the Australian batting is still fragile. Haddon has been superb. And so is Clark, and they're both, by the way, they love batting at Adelaide. I mean, the statistics are unbelievable, both averaging over 100 at Adelaide. But heading to Perth, let's not forget that, yes, there's a lot of talk about this going to be a very fast, bouncy pitch, and yes, it'll suit Australia's bowlers, but it'll also suit the English bowlers. I mean, you know, they're no bunnies either. So you've got guys like Broad and Anderson who are experienced cricketers and have played at Perth before. And, you know, I think it'll actually suit them too. Stokes, you know, he bowled reasonably well in Adelaide, and I think, you know, he'll be better for the run out. And I think they're going to have to think about their team makeup. But if they go another fast bowler or even perhaps two, it's very easy to see them forcing their way back through Australia's frail batting order.
Well, I think positive thoughts for England. In 2010, 3 years ago, the last Ashes test, England played at Perth. They had Australia 69 for 5 first innings, and then Australia recovered. England collapsed from 78 for naught in their first innings. And then Shane Watson and Mike Hussey took the game away from England. And in the end, Mitchell Johnson, who was dropped for Adelaide after not taking any wickets at the Gabba, came back in and took 9 wickets. Ryan Harris also took 9. And obviously they'll be the guys leading the attack again this weekend. At the same time, like you say, there's an England's kind of squad, bowling-wise, kind of almost been picked for this test, really. And it'd be interesting to see, you know, there's people like Finn, Tremlett, Rankin, that this is the one test that they are kind of most likely to have success in. And it'd be interesting to see what England do. I mean, let's just kind of talk about the teams now. We've got, we touched on before, that all of the batsmen, apart from Cook, at least had one decent innings in the last match. None of them went on to turn it into a big score, but they all got to 50 once, apart from Cook. And Stokes, but sorry, the top 5 plus prior. So it's difficult to... Are England just going to keep the same top 6, with including Stokes plus prior? Anderson and Broad will obviously play, barring injury. And then it's the Swan, Monty or neither kind of question, really, isn't it? And Panesar certainly outbowled Swan in the last match, but with Swan's kind of, you know, obviously he's a regular in that side. Well, theoretically, his batting is superior to Monty. We haven't really seen that much in the last kind of year or so. But Swan is a good slip catcher as well. I know. Can you? What would you expect to see, or what would you want to see if you were kind of looking, you know, as an England, from the England point of view?
From an England point of view, what I'd like to see is some positivity at the selection table, definitely. I'd like to see some proactivity as well. I think, you know, they're now certainly chasing the series. I mean, it's make or break here. There is unlikely to be a draw at Perth. There virtually never is a draw at Perth, so there'll be a result. So England, obviously, yeah, if they're on the wrong side of that result, it's game over. Yeah. So they need to make some tough decisions. Yeah. Personally, I think what they should do is, I don't think Australia fears Swan. I don't think they fear him particularly anyway, but perhaps maybe in England more so, definitely. But in Australia, no. And his record in Australia suggests that. I would drop both spinners. Not to say that Swan couldn't then play a part in Melbourne and Sydney. But for Perth, I'd like to see them keep the top seven, with perhaps Bresnan coming in at 8, because I think what that does is strengthen their batting, and let's face it, they need a bit of extra padding there, if you like. With Broad at 9, and then your 10-11 would be Anderson and other. Now, it would be one of the tall timbers that they've taken over there. So I guess, Tremlett, Finn, or Rankin, I don't think, to be honest with you, it really matters which one of them play. I was a little bit disappointed by Tremlett at the Gabba. He certainly lost a lot of pace.
Yeah.
So I'd perhaps be a little surprised if they brought him back. So I guess you're looking at Rankin or Finn. So I don't really think it matters too much. But yeah, one of them need to play.
Well, Finn took 5 wickets in the match 3 years ago at Perth. So he has played there before, although Tremlett obviously did as well. I agree. The one question for me is there any kind of history of spinner success at Perth at all?
Not really. Certainly no off spinner. The only, I think I read a statistic, the only off spinner to take more than 8 wickets at the WACA in a career too, I think this was Bruce Yardley. I believe, who used to play for, played for Australia and played for Western Australia as well. So no, there's no real history of any spinner doing particularly well there. I mean, there's an argument to be made that, and I think the Australians will play Lion, and for two reasons. I think they're loath to change a winning team, which I could understand, but I also think they like the fact that Perth offers bounce and Lion. That's one of his attributes, the bounce. So the English might argue that, well, Swan will get more bounce.
I was more thinking Panesar, to be honest, because he's the one, and he's got a good history at kind of place like Old Trafford, for example. He's tall. He gets a bit more bounce. Having said that, he does get a decent amount of his wickets, LBW, and I don't know.
He took 5 wickets in the 06-07 series as well in Perth.
Mm.
So
that's true. He did play there, didn't he?
Yeah. So, you know, yeah. I mean, it's
dropping Swan and keeping Panesar in would be a big move for the selectors. But having said that, you do sense from Flower that he's ready to do something unusual and surprising. Maybe he's going to ship Kerrigan over or something.
Well, I think they need to do something surprising. I'm not so sure about the Kerrigan move, but I think. Yeah, they need to be proactive and take the game to Australia now. And I think the best way to do that would be a barrage of five fast bowlers ready to say, right, you know, we're here to play, fast, bouncy pitch. You know, we're going to fight fire with fire here. And let's see how the Australian order copes with that because, like I say, you know, Warner's been good, Clark's been good, Haddon's been good. But the others are, you know, they've made contributions, but they're not setting the world on fire. And look, if Australia again are three or four or five for, you know, anywhere between 150 and 200, then all of a sudden England are back in the series.
And you refer to the fact there's very rarely a draw there. Not only the kind of wickets fall in clumps, but people score runs pretty quickly there. And four of the fastest seven test hundreds in history have been scored at the Wacker, including Gilchrist's 157 balls in 06-07, as you mentioned. And obviously Haydon got his 380 at the Wacker as well.
I remember Warner getting 100 against India there. I'd be surprised if that wasn't up there as well.
Yeah, yeah. So, but it's an interesting place because it's known as somewhere that, you know, is unlikely to see a draw, but runs, it's not because it's a total minefield, you know, runs will be scored.
Absolutely. Yeah,
it won't be totally low scoring.
No, absolutely. It's a good place to play cricket because it offers something for the fast man. There's bounce if you play a spinner, and it is a good... touring teams will need to adjust. I mean, that's the big thing for England as well. If they can... each batsman can spend a little bit of time... you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes, you know, just acclimatising, you know, during his innings, it can be a very good place to bat because, yeah, the bounce is true. And particularly if you're good on the cut and pull, which a lot of the English players, the top order, are, then, yeah, they can prosper. But it's just getting used to that bounce because it is different.
And just to finish off, the famous Fremantle doctor... coming in, it's going to be, you know, it can be fairly breezy, kind of certainly, you know, in between lunch and tea, for example. Is someone like Anderson maybe going to be hoping to be able to move the ball around a little bit in the air as well?
Absolutely. I mean, if you cast your mind back to the last series in Australia when Johnson took all those wickets, he wasn't particularly beating them for pace, and you know, the bouncer barrage wasn't there during that series. So, I mean, he was beating them with swing. That's going to be England's problem as well, by the way. I mean, if Johnson's time, he's bowling rapid, if he starts swinging the ball around corners, then it's going to be, you know, even more difficult for them. So that could be a problem. But conversely, absolutely. I mean, where you know, there's a strength for Australia, there's an equal strength there for England. I mean, they've got arguably the best swing bowler in the world in Anderson. And I think, yeah, if conditions suit and it's, you know, the doctor picks up, then certainly he'll be more than a handful.
Bruce Reid is a name that just pops into my head there.
Yeah, he's
Western Australian. He was quick. And was he left arm or have
he
I
was
made
left
that?
Arm? Yeah. Very tall, thin. I think he snapped in half, which is why he didn't play any more Test cricket.
But, yeah, that was a Billy Birmingham
thing,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
But so, I mean, the Perth Test match starts on Friday morning. We're saying off air that it means that Perth is the one that you can kind of watch a bit more of the final session. You can get yourself up at 6 a.m. You can watch, you know, pretty much the second half of the match, certainly the final session. And so, here's hoping that, from my point of view, that England can actually pull something. It would be, and obviously, you know, as an Australian, you're hoping for a win, but at least there would be something to play for going into the Boxing Day Test match if England can pull something out here.
Yeah, absolutely.
You almost don't care either way.
No, well, I wouldn't go that far. You know, as an Australian, you know, and a cricket fan, you know, I love the Australians doing well, obviously. And it's been far too long since we've had the little urn, so I'm definitely hoping for the Australians to play well. But I'm going to make a bold prediction here. I think England might just win this game. because I think there's been a lot of talk about how, you know, the Australians play so well in Perth, and, you know, if it's 2-0 by Perth, that'll be it. I just think that the English might turn up with a bit of a surprise here.
Do you think there's some Australian fans with pretty short memories and getting carried away with the hype of thrashing them and maybe being 5-0 and thinking, hang on, we're not actually, you know, we're good, but we're not that good yet?
Yeah, well, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think there's a bit of reservedness with most Australian fans.
Okay.
I don't think anybody's claiming this is a great team. No, not by any stretch. And I don't know if they'll ever be a great team, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, you look at the great teams in the past, there were some just unbelievable players. I think this can be a very good Australian team. But they're still, you know, learning and they're still developing. And I think most people would agree with that. What I would say is there's not a lot of difference between these two teams. And I think that's shown. But once one of them gets on a bit of a roll, it's very hard to stop. But I am making that prediction. I think 2-1 it'll be after
Ooh.
Perth.
I tried to be positive in the last game, even though in my heart of hearts I expected England to get thrashed. I tried to fight that, but no, I can't see it. I can't see it. I think this could be. I think we could be 5 days away from finally losing the urn again for the first time in. What would it be? 7 years. Well, you know, kind
2009.
Of 5 years since they won it back. Yeah. So. That's it. Thanks a lot for listening. Dom and I will be back after the Perth test, sometime just before Christmas, to review the Perth test and preview the Boxing Day test from the MCG. We won't be from the MCG, but you know what I mean. This has been 105 Sports' third Ashes podcast with me, Chris Jordan, and Dom Marsh. Thanks a lot again, Dom.
No problem. Make sure you're wearing your Santa hat too next time we're in the studio, Chris.
Okay, will do. Thanks for listening.
105 Sports.